The redshift of the atomic spectra from the galaxies, from the supernovas. So this was a complete and total surprise that the expansion rate of the universe is actually increasing. The expectation was that if anything, it should just be slowing down. Even if it were negative curvature space, it would be slowing down. It just would never stop. So this was a total surprise, and people are trying to understand the mechanism, which may be something like the inflaton field, but we don't know. Okay, so you can take all these pieces and put them together and put them in a general relativistic model of the universe, so a cosmological model, basically hot big bang thing with these different components in it. And when you do, you would actually find, depending on how you mix these things together, depending on how much dark matter, how much normal matter, how much radiation to matter, how much dark energy is in the universe as you mix it together, as it expands, you expect to see different sizes for the fluctuations on the cosmic microwave background. So if the spots on the cosmic microwave background were really, really big, you would see lots of them at, this is some measure of the sizes of the spots, you'd see a big, big peak here. If they were really, really, really tiny, you would see them more way over here. And so you can actually map the sizes of all the different spots that you see. Some are big, some are small. And you can look at the frequency of the different sizes, and you get what's called a power spectrum, which is what this is. It's basically how often you see spots of different sizes, where this is a measure of the different size, this is a measure of how often you see it. And here's the data. And inflationary hot Big Bang models with cold dark matter, so all this crap that we've been talking about, basically gives you this curve, which is the best fit. Models without inflation don't fit this so well, so this is partly why people take inflation fairly seriously. One of the things you'll see in this week's reading, Paul Steinhardt has just written an article in Scientific American where he talks about the fact that you can actually cobble together, even though it's somewhat unusual, a model that doesn't really have inflation but just has the space expanding, and get something that fits the data a bit. So this whole idea of inflation, which, as you'll see, as we've talked about, leads to these multiverses, it's contentious. Okay, it is contentious scientifically, and people are arguing about it. But if you take this power spectrum that we see, and you do basically a best fit to infer from that how much of the universe is all these different types of stuff, you end up with what's here, the cosmic pie. So about 4% of the universe is the stuff as we know it, baryonic matter, protons, neutrons, stars, and things like that. A little bit is neutrinos. Of all the normal matter, it's only about something like 70% of the universe. 25% or so. 20%, only one-fifth of that is the stuff we're used to. The rest is this dark matter. And we actually do have pretty good evidence that exists, right, from these rotation rates and everything. We know something's there that's causing the gravitational effects that we're inferring is dark matter. And then, if you look at the accelerating expansion of the universe with the flat space and all this fits together, we have to have a huge piece of the energy budget of the universe that we call this dark energy. So whatever it is that's causing this accelerating expansion, we don't know what it is, but it comes into our equations with units of energy, and we are puzzling over what it is. But if you were to sum up the entire energy budget of the universe, we actually don't know anything about dark energy yet, and we don't know what dark matter is. So we really only know about 5% of the stuff in the universe. So that's a little bit... Okay, it could be depressing or it could be really exciting, depending on your point of view. There's a lot left to discover. Yeah?
For dark matter and dark energy, would that be in the museum?
Yeah, we're going through inflation, so...
Okay.
Yeah. Okay, so All this leads to this cosmological multiverse. We've talked a bit about the bubble multiverse and the beyond the horizon multiverse, so I'll come back to those in a minute for closure. But if we have this expanding universe, in the early days, before we knew the universe had flat space, before we knew that that the expansion of the universe was accelerating, people actually thought that the expanding universe might slow down and then come back and then collapse and basically go from a big bang back to a big crunch and then into a big bang again. So there was this idea of a cyclic big bang multiverse, and actually Einstein was one of the people who thought this would be a really cool idea. One of the big problems philosophically with the big bang is you have inherently a start of time for our universe. That's very bothersome to people. So people would like to have the universe in some form of a steady state so that we don't really have to worry about a beginning or an ending. And so the idea was, okay, we know the universe is expanding. We can't get away from this sort of model of relativity. But perhaps we have this cycle. So, like this. Okay? This is a model where you have a multiverse, but this is one that I would call time separated, because you basically have this cycle, and then it comes back to something, and then this cycle. This something, okay, we don't know what that is. We don't have quantum gravity theories yet, so we can't tell you what happens when you go to a singularity. So basically the idea was we have the Big Bang, so we'd be right here, or we're right here, and something causes it. Maybe the universe is closed and there was no such thing as dark energy at the time, so that new people knew about. So they thought it would slow down, stop, and maybe come back. So this was an idea. So there are some real problems with this. So this is not a model of the multiverse that, as a scientist, I consider in the running anymore. I actually think this one is sort of ruled out for a number of reasons. Technically, of course, we don't know what happens at the crunch, so that's one problem with the model. But the other thing that makes it really implausible to me is that we know that the universe, in fact, is accelerating its expansion. So when is it going to slow down and come back and crunch? And then there's a very technical issue which people have to get around, which is called the entropy issue, which is a bit of an odd thing. There is, in thermodynamics, a measure of disorder called entropy. And as we have more and more particles in the universe, it actually increases the so-called entropy of the universe. So you will hear people talk about, we know the direction of time because entropy basically has to increase. And this is stuff that comes out of thermodynamics. I don't want to get too hung up about it. But it turns out that you have to have the quantity called entropy well behaved as you go between these two cycles. And it's not. The entropy actually changes. So the implications of this were, if you had the cyclic universe, in fact, what entropy would cause to happen is it would actually cause these cycle times to change. So as we go back in time, the cycle times would become shorter and shorter, which is really bizarre, because in the end you'd then have a start, which means this model really wouldn't do what it was supposed to do in the first place. So I don't want to get too hung up about the entropy. I mean, this is enough to sort of say it shouldn't be happening these days. But this is one type of multiverse that, in fact, was talked about for the last 100 years very seriously. Yeah.
If this multiverse idea, when it crunched and started expanding again, was it the same universe that was created, or was it different?
That depends a little bit on what happens at the crunch. I would think of it more along the lines of probably this Fecan multiverse, that when you have that, when you have the actual crunch, the physical characteristics of the space here might have quantum fluctuations and come out looking a little bit different, would be my guess, which we're going to get more into with string theory with the space idea. But okay, yep. I don't think of it as a credible model. There is a credible cyclic model that Steinhardt is talking about a little bit in this paper that I will give you reading on, and we'll talk a little bit about at the end of string theory, but that's not this. But if you Google cyclic model, you may end up with Steinhardt's and not this so much. T- 10 years ago, you'd have only gotten this. If you have inflation, we may have the bubble multiverse where you have these regions of space where you have inflation stop. And then within each of these regions, you might have regions that would correspond to like the domains of what we could be causally connected to, which could be so far apart they're actually independent. So there would be like a multiverse in here. Within each of these regions, the physical laws of the space and everything would be the same. Within different bubbles, you could be very different. So there are two distinctly different multiverses there. Once the inflation's going on, nobody knows how to stop it. Is inflation happening, or did it happen? Open question. People are looking for experimental evidence that actually would show us we had inflation. There is another model that actually Steinhardt and Turok came up with. We'll talk about it as we get into string theory more. I'll give you some reading on it. It does not require inflation. Steinhardt has a little bit of an axe to grind, which is why he wrote the article that I gave you this week. Basically, he's arguing that you can do things without inflation. That's pretty important from the multiverse point of view, because these multiverses sort of fall out of inflation for at least the cosmological ones that we've been talking about. Yes?
I don't know if you answered. What caused inflation to stop?
A quantum fluctuation in the inflaton field. So the idea is that there exists a particle, and any type of particle you have can be characterized within the quantum field theory as basically a field, so mapping onto every point in space, it might have a value. If you wanted to understand the energy of the vacuum at any given point, you would need to know, it would be determined by what's going on with those, with all these various fields. Generally speaking, the fields are such that they have zero energy. But it could be that the field is in a situation where it has some net energy, some net potential energy. And if that's the case, it actually gives an energy to the vacuum, which is a term that causes this expansion of space in general relativity. So it's a weird situation, and people never really thought of it as existing until the 1980s or so, when they realized they wanted to make this inflation happen. And people went, well, if instead of having all of these fields be at their minimum potential energy, have no energy, let's suppose that they're created where they actually have some potential energy. And so then all of a sudden, things are strange. Okay. All right, so I know what you're thinking. Oops. You're saying, this is all fine and nice, but what I really want to know is, how does string theory fit into all this? Right? All right. So, let's do string theory. Remember, when we started talking about particle physics, we found that there were lots of different strange particles. And it turned out that with all these different weird particles, people thought of all sorts of ways to categorize them. And here's a picture of different types of particles. And people were using group theory and symmetry ways to try to find them and strange sorts of things. What these are doesn't matter. It's just we had lots of particles that we discovered. And it was a very confusing picture. In fact, here you probably can't even see it. It's a list of particles, their masses, what they decay into, with what probabilities. I mean, it's like this big mess, and people didn't really understand it. So string theory actually came out of an attempt to try to understand this mess, and this was before the day of quarks. And one of the ways in which it came about, well, there was another issue, which was there were also some inherent instabilities in the way that we look at things. If you take, for example, just a positive particle and a negative particle and you let them come together, the force between them grows with 1 over r squared. So as r goes to 0, you get an infinity. So you can imagine from that, I mean, this particular one turns out theorists know how to deal with, but there are things of this nature that come up inherently in theories that are really problematic, okay? In particular, if you throw gravity in the theory, there are strangenesses that happen at zero distance that nobody knows how to handle. So these three guys, Leonard Susskind and Holger Beck-Nielsen and Yatiro Nambu, way back in the late 60s, had a different way of looking at this. And so they decided, perhaps instead of thinking of particles as point-like things, think of them as having some extent, and then think of the different particle states as excitations of this string. So think of it as a one-dimensional string, and you excite it. So in fact, this is not totally foreign to us, because we've looked at this. All right, we've looked at standing waves on strings, and if you recall, in one of the recitations, we looked at the different standing wave patterns you could have for strings fixed at an end, right? And only certain frequencies will resonate. That is, you have only certain frequencies or wavelengths where the wave going this way interferes constructively with the wave that gets reflected back, so that you get them adding together and you get particular resonant patterns. So if you have one pattern like this, you would call it the fundamental frequency of the string. This would be the first harmonic. And if you're doing real strings tied together on a guitar, you can actually solve for the frequencies of the sound that a certain string will play nicely, okay? And you did this in one of your recitations. So the idea is you find that for a given length and a given mass per unit length of the string, there are only certain frequencies which will play nicely. Okay, so the mass per unit length of the string determines the velocity of the wave on the thing, and then you have the length. So this would be one frequency, here would be another frequency. Note that these are the same except for this one number. So you have multiples of the frequency, and this is what makes music so pretty. It's the quantum mechanics of music, if you want to think about it. Okay, so it may seem sort of weird, and I guess it is. These guys said, okay, we're looking for something that gives discrete spectra, and the point-like nature of things, when they get close together, causes problems. So maybe we think of particles as having some finite extent, and we look at the vibration modes on the string, and we let each vibration mode basically correspond to a different energy, which would correspond to a different mass particle. This was basically the idea. It's more complicated than this because the strings can vibrate relativistically. That is, they can move at speeds that approach the speed of light. So the mathematics becomes awful. All right. The strange thing that they discovered was that when you take these little strings and you look at the vibrations in a relativistic way, the mathematics that you get for the different resonant states actually look very much like the mathematics that describes states in quantum field theory. There's a correspondence there. So, as you could imagine, if you noticed that, you might get really excited. And they did. Okay, they thought, wow, we have this new way of forming particle spectra and then trying to make them correspond to particles that we see or don't see. And so this was sort of the launching of string theory. Okay, so basically, I think I'm just saying what I just said. These three guys, they discovered that the mathematical description of relativistic string vibrations and rotations is similar to a description of particles with different masses and spins in quantum field theory. So they basically discovered this independently, and everybody got pretty excited about it. So one of the really cool things that they discovered was some of the states that string theory predicted did not correspond to particles that they knew existed. In fact, one of them, when they looked at it very carefully, corresponds to exactly what you would expect to have for the so-called graviton. That would be the gauge boson for gravity. And people got super excited by that, because up until this moment, there had never been a marriage between quantum field theory or particles and gravity. Only general relativity that interprets gravity as a strange curvature of space-time worked. So there was a real problem. If you tried to make a quantum field theory with gravity, it turned out that when things go to small distances, the theory becomes totally misbehaving. So this was actually a real problem in quantum field theory. But in string theory, it turned out that the graviton, or quantum gravity, just fell out naturally. So people then got very excited about string theory as potentially being a new theory of everything. It could include gravitation as well as the strong, weak, and electromagnetic interactions. Life was sort of like this for the string theorists. When they first discovered that this idea of extended string model actually could describe particles, they got very excited. In the meantime, people discovered quarks. They discovered quantum chromodynamics as a theory that worked really well to describe the strong nuclear interaction. All of a sudden, the spectrum of particles became pretty well understood. So the whole reason of existence for string theory sort of evaporated, and most people were not working on it. What got people interested in string theory again was when they realized that string theory actually predicted the existence of a particle that would actually make quantum gravity work. And then people got very excited again and said, oh, wow, string theory might be the ultimate theory that could marry gravitation in with these other forces. So they started working on it again. In quantum field theory, especially with gravity, you get these weird things happening at small distances that are a real problem. String theory, just to give you a sense of how you get around that problem in string theory a little bit, you can imagine you have two particles. As they come together, the distance between them goes to zero. And that's where the mathematics gets crazy. But imagine if instead of thinking of the particles as being point-like, imagine thinking of them as having sort of a finite extent, like two round bits of string. Okay, these could interact, and when they come together, they never go to a distance of zero because they have finite extent. So they might just marry together like that, and the mathematics never goes bizarre. So that's sort of a graphical way of seeing how you can get around some of the problems with the quantum gravity that in string theory that you couldn't get around otherwise. So people got pretty excited about it. But there were some really interesting things that came with it when they were trying to build a workable theory of string, a workable string theory. They found that if they developed the string theory, the mathematics of the string theory, in three dimensions of space plus time, there were lots of particles that it predicted that just made no sense, that had no correspondence with anything in reality. So they were not workable theories. So, for example, they call them ghost particles. The theory basically clearly didn't work in three dimensions plus time. For technical reasons, it turns out that if you wanted to create a real-world theory, you could do it if you allowed 10 dimensions to exist mathematically. Now, mentally, I know that makes no sense. But it turned out that when the mathematics was in 10 dimensions, these ghost particles all disappeared. Another thing that had to exist was a mirror symmetry between bosons and fermions. So just to remind you, Fermions are particles with these half integral spin, like the proton. So 1/2, 3/2, 5/2. And then there's these other particles called bosons that have integral spin, 0, 1, 2, 3. And they have actually different statistics. And mathematically, in many parts of these theories, the fact that what happens is that they'll come in with opposite signs algebraically. So it turns out that in a theory that allows both fermions and bosons to exist with a symmetry, that is, for every fermion there's a boson, and for every boson of a certain type. So if we have an electron, there should be, which has a fermion, there should be an electron-like particle, which is a boson. If there's a quark, there should be a quark-like particle, which is a boson. If there's a boson like a photon, there should be a fermion, which is also photon-like. They only differ in their spins. This is a pretty bizarre concept because we don't see spin 1 or spin 0 electrons. We do not see spin 1 half photons. We only have spin 1 photons, spin 1 half electrons. So you are actually doubling the particles that exist in nature, and that other half, we have no evidence exists. So it's a pretty bizarre thing. The idea is called supersymmetry. The way people get around the fact that we don't see these other particles is they argue that there's, that the symmetry is imperfect in nature, and that the particles we don't see have masses that are much higher than we've yet to observe. But at very high energies, that mass difference is irrelevant. So in the mathematics of these theories, they require this particular symmetry that exists. So we call it supersymmetry. So it turns out that string theories can have all the characteristics you would sort of like them to have in a real-world theory if they exist in 10 dimensions and have supersymmetry. Supersymmetry is also a nice idea because it can solve the problem of what does what the Higgs does in the Standard Model. So, again, people saw that supersymmetry and quantum gravity fell out naturally in these theories. Supersymmetry fixes major problems with the Standard Model, and so there was a lot of excitement about this. But then you got a problem. Okay, I guess I just said this. So we have our normal particles in the Standard Model, and then the idea is that at higher energies we would have another spectrum of particles that basically doubles this, where the spins would be different, which is a strange idea. And you would think, well, why pull that out of thin air? Except mathematically it works out really well because the different spin particles come in with different algebraic signs. So to give you a sense of what can happen, the virtual loops of particles that happen due to the quantum uncertainty principle, remember, if I have a particle going along, it could be that in fact it's other particles because of the uncertainty in energy, and we call these virtual particles, basically quantum loops. They exist for a little while and then have to come back to what you had earlier, and it has to happen over a very short time. Even though we can't observe it directly, it can affect the calculation, and there are places where these contributions become very large. If you allow other particles with the opposite spin to also exist in these loops, they come in with the opposite algebraic sign, and the loops will all cancel, so the effect just goes away mathematically. So it's an elegant thing in the math, but it sounds pretty crazy when you first think about it. But the point is, we have a lot of problems in the current theory. We don't know what does what the Higgs does. We have the problem with incorporating gravitation. We have these short distance issues as things come together. And string theory actually, in principle, can solve all of that. So people got very excited about this. But there's a problem, because string theory demands that we live in 10 dimensions, not 4. 10 plus, well, 10 dimensions, yeah, but not the 4. So we have to worry about, what does this mean to have these extra dimensions, and how do we get rid of them? It turns out that this idea of extra dimensions has actually been around for a while. even back as early as, say, 1915, right after Einstein came out with general relativity, there's a guy named Theodore Kaluza discovered that if he allowed five dimensions, he could actually create a theory that married together general relativity and electromagnetism in an interesting sort of way, in one theory. So the problem was, we don't live in five dimensions. So Einstein and Kaluza and others fretted about this for a while because this was an interesting extension of general relativity. And then there a guy named Oscar Klein came up with a way of making that fifth dimension disappear. So theories that include this mechanism are sometimes called Kaluza-Klein theories. So there's an idea of allowing the mathematics of the theory to carry an extra dimension, and then the idea is to try to make that dimension unobservable to us. So, for example, imagine that we lived in a world, we had a theory with two dimensions, but we lived in a world of one dimension. How can we make one of those dimensions disappear? You can imagine taking a two-dimensional object, curling it up into, basically attaching one edge to another edge into this long tube, okay, characterized by a radius here. And then if we were very far away, that radius would appear so small we wouldn't really see it, and this would look like a one-dimensional object. We call it compactification. So mathematically, there is a way of taking the extra dimensions and basically making them disappear if you're a large-scale object. You just wouldn't notice them. But at every point in space, they could, in principle, be there. If we were probing space on a small enough distance scale, you might begin to see evidence for these extra dimensions, okay? Which is partly what they look for at LHC, for example. You will hear about people making searches for extra dimensions, and that's what it means. They're literally probing to smaller and smaller distance scales and actually seeing if they see evidence for these other dimensions. Mathematically, this kind of game is quite possible, but does it correspond to reality? Okay with this so far? Okay. So, a little bit more history, just as we'll come back to the extra dimensions in a minute. There was a lot of excitement in the mid-80s when it was realized that string theory could include supersymmetry and fix the Higgs problem, could include quantum gravity, and could basically be a theory of everything. The hope was really the following. We know we live in three spatial dimensions plus time. The theory has to work in 10 dimensions. Okay? Well, that means we have to compactify six of those dimensions. And I gave you one example of how you might do one dimension. So if you hire your favorite topologist to sit around and tell you ways in which you might mathematically make these other six dimensions disappear, there's a whole lot of ways to do it. In fact, about 10 to the 500 different ways. The hope was that there would be a totally optimal way to do it. And when we discovered that totally optimal way to do it, we would find that the characteristics of the space-time would look exactly like what we see. So that was sort of the fun. So that was sort of the idea. So people were hoping to find a theory of everything. They hoped that basically in a scheme of how these theories were coming together and this compactification might happen, that one would turn out to be the key to everything that we see. So they came up it turned out that they found in the mid-80s that there were five self-consistent different string theories that actually held together. And they were seen to be independent, and the hope was that maybe one of these would turn out to be the basis for our theory of everything. And then in the 90s, a guy named Ed Witten, in the 90s, some other string theorists realized that these independent string theories were not as independent as they thought they were once were. That in fact, in different limits, they turned out to be the same thing. So for example, this theory, which, I mean, the name makes no sense, of course, unless you're a string theorist. This theory, in the limit that you look at things that are really small, would turn out to have the same mathematical form as this theory in the limit when you go to things that are very large. So this is something they called duality. And then in about 1995, a very famous physicist at Princeton, who's still alive and well and very influential, is named Edward Witten, hypothesized, basically inferred, that each of these is basically a special case of another theory, which would be the theory of everything, so-called M theory. Okay, and so now the trick is, can we discover what is M theory? Is that really the true theory of everything? So life became more complicated. Basically, people realized that string theories involved more than just small one-dimensional strings, that you could hypothesize different types of objects within these string theories, like points. You could have things that are like membranes. You could have three-dimensional spaces like that in which we live, which would be called a three-brain, and on up into multi-dimensional brains. So this is where the idea of the brain came in. So these kinds of structures can exist within the theory. And I'm about to describe a multiverse that involves a couple of brains. In next time, when we're talking about string theory, I mean, the basic picture is you can have all these structures. In the end, you have some 11-dimensional theory. We know we live in 3 plus time. There are like 10 to the 500 different ways of compactifying these other dimensions. And so then the question is, what happens is as you compactify the space, the different ways in which it compactifies are the things that within the string theory correspond to physical constants in our universe, like electric charge, masses or strengths of different particles. So when you take this geometric theory of things and you do the compactification, you're actually also determining the physical constants of the vacuum of the universe in which you live. Okay? So when I talk about within the bubble multiverse, fluctuations in space-time having potentially different constants, what we're saying is you have this inflating space-time and you can have the characteristics of the space changing, and when the compactification settles down, you get certain physical constants there. And that compactification can settle down in many, many different ways, like 10 to the 500 different possibilities. So that's a bit the theme of next time. We call that the cosmic landscape. So let me talk for a minute about one of the things that happens when we allow extra dimensions and we allow these weird structures. There is a cosmology that has come out, called the Ekperiodic Universe. And this is by Paul Steinhardt and Neil Turok. And this picture is not very good. Let me give you something that you can see. The idea is that within the string theory, you can't really see the other dimensions, but you can hypothesize that we live in one of the structures, a three-dimensional structure with time sort of going the way we typically infer time. So we would be living in a three-brain within some multi-dimensional space, 11 dimensions, okay? And it turns out we could have other three-brains. There could be some other three brain, and since we're allowing all these different dimensions, we could have our three brain and this other three brain displaced a little bit by one other dimension, so we can't actually see that other three brain there. But it turns out that you can create this model where you can have literally colliding three brains in an extra dimension, which is called the bulk. So actually we would have three dimensions plus one here which separates these brains, plus the others are then compactified so you can't see them. And basically in this strange sort of cyclic model, he has these three-dimensional spaces colliding, moving apart, and colliding within the bulk. Okay? What happens is that as they collide, they have a slight attraction between one another, and it actually causes them to sort of crinkle. And when they collide, where they collide, it turns out to release a lot of energy. And so they crinkle, so you get a lot of energy release, but it would be very uneven. And lo and behold, you can concoct it so that it would look exactly like a Big Bang. And then as they collide, it turns out that there's a force that would cause them to move apart. And so they hypothesize out of thin air that there's this force that causes them to sort of move apart and come together like a spring. But you can concoct the thing so that these colliding brains will create a situation that looks like the Big Bang. You have this is very big compared to any observable region that you might have, so that it would look just like the Big Bang does to us, but it would not involve inflation. And then these three brains move apart, and as they move apart, things expand and cool within each of the three brains and look just like what we see now. And they would continue to expand and cool, and that would keep happening as these things move apart and even as they're coming back together until they collide again. And this weird sort of time cyclic multiverse is called the ekperiodic universe. And it's sort of a new string theory thing, doesn't involve inflation, and Steinhardt is sort of pushing that in some of the reading that you'll see. So, is it weird enough for you? Okay, I'm done. Sorry for going long.